Christmas music is a herald for Christmas, like the Silver Surfer arriving on your planet to announce the imminent arrival of Galactus. When you hear the Christmas playlist at your department store, something shifts. You can accept it, or you can fight it, but it shifted, with or without you. And Christmas music tucks Christmas in at the end of the holiday season. Nothing signals the end of the holiday season more clearly than walking into that same store and hearing Fifth Harmony again. Now, think of how few songs are in that Christmas playlist rotation. And since Bing is singing half of them, now think of how few artists. How few that are still with us. So with Mariah as the far-flung outlier that you would throw out of a bell curve, George Michael becomes the endpoint of this long, illustrious line of great songwriters and great singers who defined what Christmas sounds like. He created Last Christmas, and he participated in Band Aid. He fought himself for Christmas number one in 1984. How crazy is that? And so that means that every year, the George Michael we get fed is bottle blonde with a comically voluminous cloud of feathery hair. It's party in the front and party in the back. This is the image, the smiling, jitterbugging, careless whispering bedroom poster that George would end up fighting for the rest of his career. This is why he grew a 10 o'clock shadow and swaddled himself in a leather jacket and reflective aviators. That guy, the world was told in 1987, that is the real George Michael. Which was just as much of a lie, even if it was one people were much happier to believe. Like any pop star with enough staying power and enough clout to spend a year or two as the world's definitive pop idol, and George was surely that in the late 80s, he cycled through a lot of identities and a lot of definitive outfits. Let's be honest, that leather jacket was just as much of a straitjacket as anything he wore in 1984. I 100% did not intend the straight jacket pun when I wrote it, I swear. But now that it's there... By 1990, George was 27, and he knew something that previous Georges had not known. Not the way that he knew it then, if at all. He was gay. He genuinely struggled with how to transform himself from this butch Elvis George Michael that the world had made a king. For 1990's Listen Without Prejudice Volume 1, he wouldn't appear on the album cover. He wouldn't do photos. He wouldn't appear in music videos. Plenty of artists have played with identity and iconography. Toyed with it, you know, had fun with it. But I don't think many have wrestled with it and had it wrestle back in quite as Herculean a manner as George did. And so... because he wouldn't appear. In the Freedom 90 video, the world's most famous supermodels mouthed along to George's plea. I think there's something you should know. I think it's time I stopped the show. There's something deep inside of me. There's someone I forgot to be. Take back your picture in a frame. Don't think that I'll be back again. I just hope you understand. Sometimes the clothes do not make the man. Season's greetings. I'm Charles Gustine, and this is Iconography, a podcast dedicated to the geography of icons, real and imagined. This is a special in memoriam episode dedicated to one of the brightest stars in the mighty constellation of British music, George Michael. But not just dedicated to him. It's dedicated to one of his most iconic totems, George Michael's leather jacket. Yes, the jacket he wore in the Faith video, of course. The jacket that announced that George wasn't the cartoon boy from Wham anymore, with the feathery blonde hair and the day-glow shorts. The jacket that David Fincher nominated for Immolation 4 years later in the Freedom 90 video. But it's not just the story of that jacket. This is also the story of leather jackets of less renown, from an era before George Michael was George Michael. Actually, just after he had stopped being Yorgos Kyriakos Panayiotou, DJ and dreamer, and became George Michael, one half of Wham. I have to confess that when I heard the news of his passing on the morning of the 26th, I didn't know anything about this protoplasmic era of Wham. I knew the same 4 or 5 George Michael songs that I suspect every other American born after 1987 knows. Last Christmas, of course. Faith, Freedom 90, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, and some snippets of Careless Whisper, mostly that saxophone riff. Which means that, sadly, I went 27 years without Wham rap in my life. Welcome to 1982. Margaret Thatcher is Prime Minister, and there's a good chance that you, like over 3 million other people in the United Kingdom, are unemployed. Sorry about that. Hey everybody, take a look at me. I've got street credibility. I may not have a job, but I have a good time with the boys that I meet down. If you are unemployed, then you're receiving financial assistance from the Department of Health and Social Security, the DHSS. You're living on the dole. Now, Thatcher's government is trying its darndest to bring about Social Security's death by a thousand cuts. Thatcher famously believes there is no such thing as society, so providing that pretend unit with security is absurd. A healthy welfare state, a healthy dole, incentivizes laziness, so why not increase taxes on Social Security and sales tax, and cut income taxes? Make people want to work. Now, there are signs that things might be turning around on the horizon, but the last few years under Margaret Thatcher have been miserable as a result. It's tough to fix a recession by telling all those lazy layabouts to find jobs that have recently dried up and therefore do not exist. Companies are looking out for their bottom line. Individuals are looking out for themselves. Unemployment has soared. There have been riots. So, since you're out of work, and the stipend provided by the DHSS is enough to get by on for right now, may as well listen to some music. Watch some telly. Have you seen the boys from Wham yet? They are just that, boys. On tour, they'll play a really amusing video where they each wake up, presumably hungover, at their respective parents' houses, and then they horse around at their North London school. George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley are 19 years old, and they've known each other since they were 11. School chums with dreams of stardom, they did this ska thing for a while as the executive, and yeah, that didn't work out, and so they made a rough demo tape of snippets of some of George's songs in the front room of Andrew's flat, and within 4 weeks, they were signed to a record deal. Not a great deal, mind. It's a deal that they'll soon be trying to break, but it got them here, on your television. You probably first saw them on Top of the Pops, November 4th, 1982. Good evening, welcome to Top of the Pops. At that time, they were not, in fact, at the Top of the Pops, nor had they been at the Top of the Pops previously. Their second single from Fantastic, their debut album, had stalled out below the top 40. But they'd talked their way onto a children's program recently, and they'd done well, and Top of the Pops needed a fill-in, so there they were. the performance that would indeed propel them into the upper echelons of the Pops. George and Andrew start the performance behind DC Lee and Shirley Holloman. It's tough to see them. But then, George Michael pops out and sneers, "Hey, sucker!" He wears a sleeveless leather jacket with no shirt underneath. I think it's fair to assume that this look, this aesthetic choice that they had made, might have had just as much to do with Wham's subsequent fame as the song that they were singing, Young Guns, Go For It. It seems like fate that George's given name, Yorgos, looks on paper like this really heinous misspelling of gorgeous. He's still got some baby fat on that teenage face, but he is a stunner. Perfectly coiffed black hair, killer jawline, a round face with intriguingly expressive eyebrows, a tan, fit body. He looks like Johnny Depp will look in a few years in Crybaby. What about Andrew Ridgely, the other guy in Wham? Well, it's tough to get a beat on him at first. He's not singing. He's still behind Shirley Holloman, but once George pulls him out from behind Shirley, we get our first good look at him. He's got cute doe eyes, and he's very thin. He's decked out in a short-sleeve button-up. He looks non-threatening, especially next to George. Preppy. He looks preppy. He's the square to George's greaser. It's all part of the act. In this song, George's character is scolding Andrew's character for getting engaged to Shirley's character. Heaven forfend, he's willing to leave the young gun lifestyle for death by matrimony. For shame. And eventually, after Shirley disses George, Andrew, he's so incensed that she would talk about his mate that way that, well, he comes to his senses. And in the music video, this is symbolized by Andrew removing his tie. Clothes tell an important story here. These are becoming recurring roles for Andrew and George. In the Wham Rap video, George struts the streets in a white t-shirt and black leather jacket, saying how cool it is to live on the dole, all for the benefit of poor Andrew, who sits at home, taking abuse for not having a job from his scornful parents. Andrew looks sad, with a milky white sweater draped across his shoulders. And then in this deliriously comical beat a little later in the video, Andrew, who's starting to like this have some fun while you're on the dole philosophy, he gets thrown a matching leather jacket to George's, and he unleashes the most doofy smile that you will ever have the pleasure of seeing. It's a delight. Even after just a smattering of videos and performances, you're probably already wondering, as 1983 approaches, what exactly it is that Andrew Ridgely does in Wham, other than look cute as a button and give good interview. George has the lion's share of the songwriting credits, and he's the protagonist in all the videos, and he does all the rapping, and it seems like all the singing. As a matter of fact, this is a time before Wham has really figured out it's a duo and not a four-piece, as you can hear in this clip.
This is Wham from England. They've just flown in. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
I'm Shirley.
My name's George.
I'm Dee.
And I'm Andrew.
So, given that it's not exactly clear what the membership of Wham is at this point, you'd probably rank everyone's relative significance to Wham as George first, obviously, then probably Shirley Holloman, and then a tie at the bottom between Andrew and DC Lee. Now, eventually, the girls will change to different girls, and that aspect of Wham will fade completely into the background. But this presumption of equality between Andrew and George as equal partners will persist until Wham splits in 1985, even if everyone knows that that's all a bit of a lark. How does this happen? We'll have to leave our 80s bubble and come back to the present for my preferred metaphor. If Wham is clueless, then Andrew Ridgely is Cher, the cool kid who finds a socially awkward dreamer and transforms them.
Ugh, as if!
George was that kid. He is Andrew's tie. And this period in the early 80s, before George gets restless and starts paving the way for his solo career, is that period where Ty thinks she still needs Cher. And I do think that George needed Andrew at this point. They really were best friends, both sons of immigrant fathers, and I think that George took a lot of inspiration from Andrew. In the videos, George may look the cool dude in leather, letting the nerd steal his shine, but in real life, things were reversed. Not to put too fine a point on it, but even though, by all accounts, especially his own, George had no idea he was gay at this point, something must have felt off. Even if that just felt like a general inkling of not fitting in. But Andrew was confident, popular, king of the school. I think that a lot of the time, George was writing about Andrew at this early stage in his career. In multiple documented cases, this is literal. Andrew was actually the one who had written a note to his mom, asking her to wake me up, and then realizing his mistake cheekily, before you go. And it was Andrew, not George, who was living large on the dole when George wrote Wham Rap.
I mean, it was very much based on Andrew's lifestyle, the idea of, you know, living off the state when when really your mother's a teacher and your father works at Canon, you know, and you've got a perfectly healthy life at home and they're not making you put anything towards the housekeeping, but you just go off and get your money every week. He loved it. So that was what we wrote about.
I think it's easy, maybe a little too easy, to look back on the George Michael of 1983 in his Danny Zuko getup writing political satire about the DHSS and see the young man's authentic expression of himself, you know, before he compromised and started writing glitzy pop songs. But I don't think that George has quite found his unique voice here. One notable thing about a lot of these early hits is that they feature a bridge sung from the enemy's perspective. The angry fiancé, the scornful parents. It's chameleonic songwriting. And the swagger George projects here, it seems like a mix of Andrew's voice, the cool kid, but also the voices that he heard while he was DJing. Because, listen to it. I mean, does this sound like any sort of George Michael that we'd hear again? If you're a pub man, or a club man, maybe a jetpack guy with a hip hi-fi, a white cool cat with a trilby hat, maybe leather and studs is the way you act. What Wham Rap and Young Guns do sound like is someone play-acting both sides of a mythical 1979 meeting between Michael Jackson and the Sugar Hill Gang. It's off the wall, and then you get to the verse, and it's rapper's delight. It was a bit odd. This early in the history of hip-hop, as something that was sold on records, and just as political rap is becoming a thing thanks to the message, to hear this coming from two lads from North London.
And it's rather unusual, because you're an English band, and you're rapping.
Yeah, that's right. We've got a name for ourselves in England as a rapping band.
Here's Dick Clark trying to wrap his head around it when the band came over to play American Bandstand for the first time.
When I was walking behind here, I heard them singing. I said, sounds like a rap record from Detroit, Michigan or something. Then I look over and I say, this is an English group? This is very unusual. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Wham! What was your musical influence? I said earlier to you, I thought it was a Detroit sound, a rap sound, a black sound. What do you listen to at home?
I listen to a lot of pop, American and English. A lot of old Tamla I like. But basically just anything you can dance to.
I'd like to take a brief detour into Keanu, the Key and Peele comedy with the cat, and its obsession with George Michael. It's actually a bit surprising considering how much Key and Peele delve into the racial tensions inherent in a black man liking George Michael that this whole English rap era never comes up in the movie. And this could be due to any number of reasons. The film is about code switching and cats. It doesn't have time to delve too far into George's discography. And also, the film only seemed to have licensing rights to George's solo work and not his Wham stuff. But not acknowledging the fact that George Michael broke out as a rapper, which he did, it does some strange things to the whole bit's central premise. For some context on Keanu, through a whole lot of shenanigans, Key and Peele's characters are pretending to be gangsters so they can get back this cute kitten that has become Peele's emotional lifeline. While Peele negotiates a drug deal with Anna Faris, playing Anna Faris, Key is back in the car and he has to explain why Freedom 90 is on this bad gangsta's iPod.
This sound kind of white.
White? White?
As we heard, that's probably not what someone would have said in the 1980s, even once George abandoned rap and switched to soul music. To win over the gang, Key ends up inventing this whole scenario where George might have capped Andrew Ridgely.
And then George Michael's trying to do that solo thing, right? And then wham! Then nobody never see Ridgely ever again.
It's hilarious. And within the film, it works wonders. One of the crew goes and gets a George Michael tattoo. But I wonder what would have happened if his character had simply played Wham! Raps. Probably laughter, a lot of derision. But if you think about it, considering the crowd and the time period, maybe not that much more laughter than if he'd played some Curtis Blow.
Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way they dribble up and down the court. Just like I'm the king on the microphone, so it's Dr. J and Moses Malone.
Suffice it to say, you could write an entire thesis on the first line the world ever heard George Michael rap.
Everybody take a look at me. I've got street credibility. I may not have a job, but I have a good...
But we must move on. Ready to go back to the 80s again? There is one thing that I cannot disagree with Keanu on. It really would be great to suddenly find yourself dancing with George Michael in the Faith video.
George Michael. You're George Michael, man.
Welcome to 1987. Margaret Thatcher is still Prime Minister. Her 1983 victory was a ridiculous landslide that made the opposition look silly. Her recent victory in June, her third victory, well, that's the first time that that's happened since 1820. What could explain the unprecedented success of such a controversial leader? Well, I mean, the economy recovered. Britain looks strong as a foreign power, and strong as a domestic entity. And a certain class of people are making loads of money.
I've got piles! Piles and money!
Maybe you're one of those people now. If you are, the shiny new pop stars of the class of 83 to 85, namely Duran Duran and Wham and Frankie Goes to Hollywood, they are your yuppie soundtrack. Girls, fun, drinks, Mediterranean holidays, cars, yachts, big hair. And if you don't happen to be one of those people, you probably hate everything that Wham and George Michael stood for. As Steve Pond will put it in Rolling Stone soon, a lot of people hate him. He knows this. He is, it seems, too perfect, too prefab, too blatantly pop to take seriously. He made his name and his fortune writing insanely catchy songs. He was an English pretty boy with the commercial instincts to come up with radio-ready material, the good looks to attract squealing teenage girls, the marketing savvy to hit that target audience. He danced through his first videos in carefully tailored black leather, then in gleaming white suits, bottle blonde hair, and glittering gold earrings that perfectly set off that Saint-Tropez tan, and finally in immaculately groomed stubble. He is ridiculously famous. He has more money than he can spend. And for most of his brief career, he has had virtually no artistic credibility. How did the kids rapping about living off the dole become symbols of the nouveau riche? Well, George had not intended the fourth single off of Fantastic, Club Tropicana, to be the peon to expensive holidays abroad that people took it to be. It was supposed to be a cheeky parody of theme nights at nightclubs, but boy, he sure leaned into the mistaken interpretation when the winds of culture started to change. The Club Tropicana video, with George in the skimpiest white bathing suit, marked the beginning of a new era for Wham, the era that defined them. Giant hair, giant hits, giant smiles. But that's all over now, in 1987. Have you seen Andrew Ridgeley? I ask because he's disappeared from the public eye since Wham dissolved in 1985. Maybe you were one of the 72,000 people out of the million that applied, lucky enough to get a ticket to their final show, named appropriately The Final. Now you've heard that Andrew is off in Monaco racing cars, you think? He's well taken care of for life, because George gave co-writing credits to Andrew on a bunch of songs that Andrew didn't necessarily co-write. You're happy for him. But, have you seen George Michael? Has there ever been a man who looks as perfect as George Michael looks in the Faith video? There are a lot of signature looks from your decade, denizen of 1987, that people will think of as silly in a decade or two. And George Michael has worn plenty of them. But this look is not one of them. The camera treats George like you would treat a Michelangelo sculpture, taking him in slowly from bottom to top, soaking up every feature. The sunglasses emphasize George's eyebrows and the sexy I'm concentrating crease between them. The immaculate stubble adds dimension to his baby face. It was actually the first thing he used to seem older, even back when Wham was still a going concern. And the leather jacket, jeans, and boots highlight what the gyrating hips say, and what the mouth that sneers when it goes, "Oh!" says, and what the bow diddly beat and the rockabilly inflection say. They say, "I am your British Elvis." George is a grown-ass man now. And he sounds it. He seems to be in full command of his voice, both as a songwriter and as a singer, whether that voice is bathed in reverb or whether it's a soft whisper. It's tempting to think that this is finally his authentic voice. Not that it isn't still black in a lot of ways. After all, it was Bo Diddley who invented the Bo Diddley beat. But where the "look at me, I'm rapping" voice and the leather jacket seemed more like a teenager playing dress-up back in 1982, this return to the leather jacket after years as a mouseketeer feels right. And that story of transformation is certainly the one that George, and even Andrew all the way from Monaco, are going to be selling to Steve Pond when Rolling Stone comes knocking for a big feature in a few months. Michael was clearly the brains behind the music, Ridgeley having somewhat reluctantly surrendered his input when they realized Michael's talents could make them huge stars. But to many people, being the brains behind Wham was tantamount to having no brains at all. "Every time I walked into a room," he says, "I felt I had to go around proving I wasn't brain dead. It definitely got out of hand. I mean, I don't know where I lost the plot and became that person with long blonde hair and the teeth and the earrings. I don't know if I woke up one morning and suddenly was that person." So he made changes. He has added a calf-length jacket to his standard black clothes and white socks outfit. He looks and sounds like a healthy, immaculately groomed, expensively dressed pop star. It's similar to the look he shows the public, the thoughtful, bearded, dark-haired, serious George Michael we now see is, he swears, the real George Michael, not the latest commercial calculation. But should we believe him? "No one will ever know more about George Michael than they probably do about the next man in the street," says Andrew Ridgeley. But nowadays, he's letting his real character come out a lot more in his music, Wham was very much a created, artificial image, and George's image is a lot closer to what he actually is in person. But there are some red flags all over this piece from January 1988 that hint at something that won't be confirmed to the public for another full decade. The years-old rumors that George is gay get brought up. I've always thought that people speculated so much because I was so quiet about my private life, he says. And secondly, because I've always had a very ambiguous-sounding voice. I'm not exactly Bruce Springsteen to listen to, you know? The piece also goes into George's predilection for difficult women he can't have, and into his long-distance girlfriend, American DJ Kathy Jung, who appeared in the I Want Your Sex video with him. Jung lives in LA, satisfying one of his criteria for an ideal partner. Distance. I can see settling down one day, he says, but I really am incredibly demanding in the sense that I only want people around me a certain amount of time. It doesn't matter how much I love someone. If they're under my feet more than a couple of days, I'm climbing up the walls. There's stuff like this all over his interviews, and honestly, all over his songs, going back to the very beginning. We live in glorious days where we are encouraged to make queer readings of all sorts of texts, whether those messages were intended by the creators or not. And the fact that George Michael did turn out to be gay makes queer readings of I Want Your Sex or Young Guns all the more tempting. I mean, come on, Young Guns is about a guy telling his best mate not to get married so they can hang out more. But this period, the late 80s, appears to be when George realized he was gay. He would come out to a friend later in 1988. And I think it's fair to respect that and not go too crazy looking for gay subtext in early Wham hits. In 1998, George was arrested by an undercover cop for cruising for sex in a public park's restroom. Rather than go into hiding, he was very open in confirming what most people had suspected since at least 1990, if not before, and what most people who knew him already knew. He actually had a great deal of fun with it in his first single after the incident, Outside, this marvelous and intentional LGBT anthem with a knowing video where George dresses up as a cop busting people for having sex in public. The video raised an eyebrow at the people. Gay men are just like everyone else, it said. Sometimes they like to get frisky in somewhat risque places. Here's a great moment from a 2004 interview with Graham Norton.
I mean, obviously, you can't come on a show like this without mention of the wanking in the toilet thing. And
which wanking in the toilet thing? Which one?
The arresting.
Oh,
the arresting.
Of course.
That one. Yeah, the one we've heard about. And
the time I got caught, you mean?
Yeah, that one. Yeah. Possibly the last time. And see, this is the thing. This is the thing that amazes me. The way you talk about it is it, your fantastic sort of unapologetic emotions.
Well, I mean, what's to apologise for? You know, I'm a gay man. I'm at the time I was like 36 years old. To be perfectly honest, it was a lovely park.
In his big official coming out interview with CNN in 1998, he was very contrite for breaking the law, but was not one bit apologetic for being who he was, thank goodness. There is one thing that he did get very serious about, though, because he worried that his legions of fans might feel like all those songs he wrote about being in love with girls and lusting after girls, that those might all be a lie.
I do want people to know that the songs that I wrote when I was with women were really about women, and the songs that I've written since have been fairly obviously about men. So I think in terms of my work, I've never been reticent to, in terms of defining my sexuality. I write about my life, and I want people to know, especially people who loved the earlier stuff, especially if they were young girls at the time, whatever, there was no bull there, you know.
George, why do you feel compelled to open up a very...
But he would even be able to laugh about that in the coming years. There's this great moment in a 2004 interview where he cracks up Matt Lauer and the entire Today Show production team behind the camera when he admits that while he may not have known he was gay in 1983, he probably never did anything as publicly queer-coded as the Club Tropicana video.
When you went on CNN and said to that audience, by the way, I'm a homosexual, mm-hmm. most of the people I knew said, I don't think that's a big surprise.
Absolutely. the funny thing is, actually, I think that the truth is that actually whether you're gay or straight, as a man, I think a lot of kind of the softer elements of who you are in your early 20s are gone by the time you're 40. And funnily enough, I think now that people know I'm gay, I probably appear less gay than I did at 22, because, I mean, you look at the videos, and I'm sorry, who needed to be told?
You didn't need a sign, did you?
Just, you know, I've got curtain rings in my ears, and I'm wearing Dayglow and rolling my eyes, and I didn't know I was gay, you know?
You were the last one to figure out.
Absolutely. There were other people, you know, I was 22 years old, and there were people much older than me. I'm quite sure a lot of gay ones thinking, boy, work it out, you know, get there, because I certainly didn't know at that particular time.
One of the great things about George is that for such a giant star, he could take the piss out of himself better than any comedian could. Not in the way that stars go on The Tonight Show with Fallon today and play beer pong to prove they're normal people too, ha ha ha. No, George could keep up with Graham Norton or James Corden. He could do laps around them. But there was a time when that wasn't the case. When George's crushingly popular public image as George Michael directly contradicted the person he knew he was and wanted to be. And from that uncomfortable moment came great art. We have to time travel back one more time now. We have to see that leather jacket burn. Welcome to 1990. Margaret Thatcher is finally not Prime Minister anymore. Her party is still in power, but she resigned after a challenge from within the party ranks. The economy is showing signs of recession again. Yeah, the 1980s seem a bit like a fever dream. Did all of that really happen? Have you seen George Michael? He doesn't seem to be anywhere. His face, at least. His voice is everywhere. Freedom 90 is everywhere. Listen Without Prejudice Volume 1 is everywhere. But not those eyebrows, not that body, not that jacket. Well, actually, the jacket does make a really critical cameo in 1990. But George wasn't in it. George has refused to appear in promotional photos for this album. He's not on the album cover. He is not in the Freedom 90 video. But even though all we see is the world's top supermodels mouthing along to George's voice, George's words, everyone knows this is a George Michael video, even if they're watching on mute. Because there's the jukebox, the guitar, and hanging in the closet, there's the jacket. You get to be coy like this when you have iconography this potent. Even the title of Freedom 90 is a reference. Pretty much everyone listening to this song in 1990 knows this isn't the first song George has written called Freedom. That Wham Hits melody was the one that you heard on the organ at the beginning of Faith. By 1990, at 27, George Michael has a whole universe of his own making to play with. He doesn't even have to show his face. Not that the record company or MTV thought that this was a good idea. Far from it. The Freedom 90 video became an instant classic, but disagreements over George's insistence that he wouldn't play nice with the camera anymore locked up his next album of new material for 5.5 years. An eternity for a pop star, basically the time period between Wham's first number one hit in 1984 and Freedom 90. So why do it? Why blow it all up? Literally. Why blow up the jukebox and the guitar and set flame to the jacket? I mean, it's all right there in the song, in the lyrics. If George had written those lyrics, laying it all out there, the story of Wham and of the public George Michael, as confessional and as honest as anything that he's said in interviews. Or maybe I'm the one falling into the authenticity trap now. If he'd written those lyrics and then he'd mugged for the camera while singing them, then the lyrics would have been a lie. You can feel comfortable doing any queer readings of Freedom 90 you want. By this point, he knew. And while he wasn't going to say it in so many words, Freedom 90 was letting people know that he wasn't that guy in the Faith video. Who he was as a star was not who he was as a person, never had been. He still wanted you to hear him, but now he wanted you to hear him. Hear this thing. Sometimes the clothes do not make the man, he sings. And that's true. George Michael was so much more than the outfits that immortalized him, in ways so vast it's pointless to list them. But as we've seen over and over again, from the sleeveless leather jacket he wore on Top of the Pops in 1982, and through every costume change that followed, each a response to the popularity of the last costume, maybe, probably, the clothes do make the star. If they didn't, that moment in Freedom 90 wouldn't be as powerful as it is. The act of burning the jacket speaks for itself. In that instance, the clothes didn't even need the man. He wasn't even there, and it may be the truest thing that he ever said. Happy New Year, you wonderful listeners, you. I write, edit, and produce this podcast myself, so you better believe that I will have faith stuck in my head for a long while. And my New Year's resolution is to keep making it for you, and to keep making it better. So let me know what you think. Rate and review the podcast at iTunes, and visit the Facebook page, facebook.com/iconographypodcast. And check out the website for extra content, iconographypodcast.com. I'll be back in the new year with a new episode about a once mighty icon you don't hear about that much in England anymore, outside of that song about the lords leaping and the ladies dancing. Twelfth Night